open the Oregon State Senate's Committee on Revenue for the last day of March. What? When's daylight savings time?
Saturday night.
Saturday night. Spring forward. I'm excited. And tomorrow is April Fool's Day. I have a little.
Well,
please.
You know, 49 years ago, this day fell on a Sunday. Oh, no, it fell on a Saturday. I'm sorry. But the next day, Sunday, was Easter Sunday, April Fool's Day, Easter Sunday, 49 years ago. I know that quite well because on this day, 49 years ago, my wife and I said, I do.
Huh. Today's your anniversary?
That's right.
Huh.
49.
49 years, Senator Starr has been married. Wow. So next year on this date will be the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, isn't it?
Are y'all amazing? Are y'all gonna do anything or?
Yeah. Oh, we're going to enjoy.
Enjoy. Wow.
50 years. I'm on like year three and.
So 50.
It feels like 49.
No. My wife works in the building, and they monitor these. They monitor these hearings, and we are, Senator Starr. We are inspired by 50 years, and we'll meet you there. Okay, so let's do. We're going to do Senate Joint Resolution 14 first, and then SB 315 second. And Senator Devlin, I knew you were on your way because I passed you on the highway.
I never saw you again.
I realize
it is tail lights.
Open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 14. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair and committee members, SJR 14 is a constitutional amendment proposal subject to voter approval. It deals with property tax measures on the ballot. It eliminates the double majority requirement on all property tax measures voted on after June 15, 2006, and it restricts when property tax measures can be voted on to the November general election and the May election in either an even or an odd year, so all May elections. And it would be submitted to the voters at the May 2006 primary election.
Well, we talked as a committee, and this is an approach that might have some favor here. So Senator Devlin and Representative David, what's your middle name?
Jeffrey.
David J. Hunt. Sounds official. Welcome.
He says that with such reluctancy.
I know.
We're not your parents. We're not going to say you're Jeffrey.
We might. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill before the committee. Representative Hunt, both of us are here today to support Senate Joint Resolution 14. I have handed in written testimony, so I'm not going to read from that, but I have a few notes, and I would like to bring a few items forward. The purpose of this resolution is, in a sense, not to repeal the double majority, but to replace it. That may seem like a distinction without a difference, but I think that there is a real distinction. The intent of this resolution is in no way to simply open up every election for a property tax election, all of the elections that you'd have every year. I remember very well the history of this, and to be quite honest, this is one of the few committees that I've appeared for before this session, where every member here in this committee, at least, actually every member on this committee, even those not present, were here in 1997 after Measure 47 had passed and experienced how long it took the revenue committees in this building to deal with Measure 47, probably one of the most poorly written measures that has ever been passed on the ballot. And in many people's minds, actually raised constitutional questions that if we had not replaced it with Measure 50, which was the legislative referral to replace it, we would have probably been in a great deal of litigation and we would have probably had some very real difficulties in terms of the fiscal structure of this state. When we replaced Measure 47, or proposed a replacement, in 1997, many people felt, including myself, that we had to mimic 47 and all the elements of it because it was so important that it actually be replaced. So we actually put the double majority requirement in Measure 50. We actually also simultaneously referred Measure 53 to the ballot a year later, which was an actual repeal of the double majority. That measure failed at the ballot by 51-49%, so it was a relatively close election. One of the justifications for the double majority was that jurisdictions were referring measures to special elections that had relatively low turnout. In fact, I think there is some merit in at least that argument that some measures were referred to special elections that had low turnout. Probably even a better solution then would have been to limit the number of elections when you would have had property tax measures, not a double majority. And I'll explain later why I think that's the case. But our elections have changed substantially since then. Vote by mail has become a common practice. There's no such thing as an election that people don't know about. If you're a registered voter, you receive a ballot. So I think that argument is a little bit fallacious at this time. Why am I suggesting a replacement rather than just simply a repeal? To be quite honest, it's for political reasons. I don't like to deny the fact that in some ways, I'm a politician. I don't think that's necessarily a terrible term, nor do I think a lobbyist is a terrible term, or a few others that you could
suggest. You want to say staffers, too, and you got everyone in the room.
Yes. But the reason is that I think a repeal, an absolute just repeal, would stand far less chance of approval by the voters on the ballot. A replacement like this, I think, stands a fairly good chance on the ballot. Why did I pick these three elections? First of all, if you look at the last 6 to 8 years, you will see that the state has done much to move literally all significant items to these three elections. The two off, the off-year, odd-year May election, the regular primary, and the general election. As you may recall, we actually moved all special district elections, school board elections, to the off-year May election from March. There are other proposals in this building. Representative Hunt has a proposal in the House that also adds the odd-year November election. Finally, I'd like to say just a few things in general about why I think that the double majority is a problem. It first of all, tries to address a problem that really no longer exists. Many measures have failed that have had broad public support merely because they fell a few votes below the 50% turnout rate. My clear reason, though, goes beyond that. My clear reason for opposing the double majority goes that I think it's against all of the things that make this nation what it is. It goes against self-determination. For over 200 years, people have fought and have struggled to maintain our self-determination. One of the clear evidences of that self-determination is the right to vote and the right to participate. A double majority actually gives more weight to not participating than participating. I don't personally have a problem if voters want to turn down measures or approve measures. If they want to participate and make that decision, that's fine with me. To be honest, though, if a voter tells me that they can't take the trouble to turn in three ballots that are mailed to them in a two-year period, I think we have a lot more problems in this representative democracy than just the double majority. I think you'll seldom hear anyone quote this quote, but I was going to use it anyway because I learned this quote in grade school. In fact, I learned the entire speech. But I think it'll be all of you actually will recognize it. We here highly resolve that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. Abraham Lincoln, Gettysburg Address, November 19, 1863. I believe Abraham Lincoln didn't believe in a government by the apathetic, for the apathetic, shall not perish from this earth. Colleagues, I quite honestly think that if Abraham Lincoln were here today, he would tell you that a double majority really has no permanent place in our Constitution.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the Lincoln quote.
The Lincoln delivery was so reminiscent of
I was taking the president. Beard was there.
The beard,
no shorter and, no. And a lot heavier.
Yeah. Distribution is exactly the same. It's all there.
The eloquence was equal. Representative Hunt. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here. It's my privilege to join Senator Devlin in support of SJR 14. You do have testimony in front of you. Let me just try and hit a few high points of it. As Senator Devlin mentioned, we have introduced also HGR 14 in the House, very similar in intent, slightly different in content. As I look at Oregon's double majority election requirement, to me it's clearly broken. The first two examples of that brokenness happened to occur in my district, in the North Clackamas and Oregon City school districts back in 1997. Where a majority of voters approved two construction bond measures for each of those districts. And yet, because of the double majority election requirement, the fact that they only got 46 or 48% of the turnout meant that both those measures went down. Now, ultimately, several elections later, after lots of energy, lots of time, lots of money was put in by those districts and volunteers, they were able to come back in another election and get both of those passed. So, It really is a tragic issue of non-voters being able to trump the will of voters. And as Senator Devlin has eloquently said, that should not be what we're about affirming. We should not be affirming that non-voters have more power than those who choose to vote yes or no. I would affirm that back in 1996 there was a problem. There were some local governments who were putting measures out in these more obscure elections when people were not likely to vote. As Senator Devlin has said, that situation has clearly changed as a result of vote by mail, as a result of the fact that we've narrowed down from 8 elections to 6 to 5 to 4, and this measure would narrow it down even further to 2. So two per year and 3 per biennium, that would be double majority free.
Now, do we have our testimony contradicting each? No, okay, good.
Yeah, this measure would. You know, right now we have the March, May, September, and November elections. This would eliminate two of those elections. So back in the early 90s, we had 8 elections per year. People could legitimately say every few weeks we have another election coming, and they could also legitimately say we don't really always know when it's happening because we have to go to our polling place to vote. That's a very difficult argument to make in light of vote by mail and the reduction in the number of elections. I would also like to quote another much more recent Republican in my testimony, Kevin Mannix, who said, quote, "I think that we need to revisit the double majority requirement. With vote by mail, there are no more sneak elections, and the double majority isn't needed," unquote. I think some will argue that reforming the double majority is trying to overturn the will of the voters, an argument we often hear in this building. And I think there are at least 3 reasons why that is an unfair argument. First, this measure was part of a much larger Measure 47 and then ultimately Measure 50. It was not the core issue. If you go back and think about and look at that campaign, that was not an election about the double majority. That was an election about the broader issues within Measure 47 and Measure 50. Second, if you look at the repeal that went out of this body in 1998, that nearly passed on a 51-49 vote, it was a full repeal. It was not this moderate approach that you have before you today. And third, as we've talked about earlier, the addition of vote by mail and the reduction in the number of elections each year has dramatically altered the situation since voters first approved this in 1996. So the arguments about overturning the will of the voters, I just don't think stand. The tragedy really is that dozens of school districts, cities, counties, public safety agencies, community colleges, a whole variety of local governments have been unable to implement essential measures despite the approval of the majority of their voters. And if you look back at the history that I think you'll see from the League of Oregon Cities, not only have they been unable to implement measures that have passed, but by a majority but failed under the double majority. But in many of those elections, if everyone that it would take to meet that gap between, to make that gap up to the 50% election turnout, if every single person had voted no, the measure still would have passed because these measures are passed so overwhelmingly. I think the core issue for me is that non-voters should not be able to trump the will of voters. No one should be rewarded for not participating in an election. SJR 14 is an opportunity to reaffirm our support for democracy over apathy. We should not continue to reward Oregonians who sit on the sidelines during an election and don't even take the time to return their ballot. So I'd urge this committee in taking action to adopt double majority reform and to refer this measure onto the ballot. And again, thank you for scheduling this hearing and taking the time to hear us today.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? For clarity, how many times in a two-year period would folks have the, if voters pass this, which I would agree that this might be more enticing to voters than the, I believe it was a close vote on an outright repeal. I believe it was actually really close, but this one would be in a two-year period, they would have three opportunities. So local communities would
have
three.
The odd year May election, the regular primary election, and the regular general election. And the reasoning for that is what I stated before. We've basically tried to narrow the number of elections that we actually utilize. Probably the only appropriate purpose for some of the other special elections that are left, and I'm not saying that I'm the guide of what's an appropriate purpose, is an emergency situation where you've got to replace someone on a board or some local government or something like that where you've actually got to run a special election. I don't think that in terms of property taxes, someone can try to make a case, but in terms of operating, to get the funds in the following November, you have to have the election in May. So this would basically give you the opportunity in terms of operating to go both Mays. Adding a November wouldn't actually help anything there, in a sense, because you still would not get the funds if you went to a November election. Someone could make the case that you might have to wait up to a year on a bond measure that had failed to take it back to the voters. But I'll tell you quite honestly, if a bond measure fails and it's in a direct vote of the people and the people that participate, maybe you should wait a year and rethink that bond measure before you refer it back to the voters. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of jurisdictions have been forced to refer measures back multiple times, more just simply to get the double majority on the measure than the fact that the measure had failed at the polls. Mm-hmm. A measure failing at the polls is a message, particularly if it's simply that the voting public that actually participated turned the measure down.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, of those three, it's important to remember one of those already under even Measure 47, Measure 50, is already double majority free. That even-numbered November is already simple majority rules. This would add the two additional Mays.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Kathy Eaton, Helen Mayer, Helen Berg, David Barenberg.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cappy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm not going to re-echo what has been given to you by Senator Devlin and Representative Hunt, but just a couple of points that the League would like to bring to your attention. We support an open governmental system that is representative, accountable, and responsive. And we believe that a healthy democracy requires both the opportunity to vote as well as ensuring that every vote counts. Oregon's current system of mandating a supermajority in local fiscal issues has frustrated the ability of communities to improve both educational opportunities and civic activities, and also has thwarted the will of the voter. It is essentially undemocratic to nullify a majority vote in favor of a fiscal proposal because less than 50% of the registered voters participated. We believe that Senate SJR 14 revises the present double majority requirement by allowing a taxing district to submit measures at regularly scheduled even-year elections and one May election in an odd-numbered year. The proposal takes away the ability of non-voters to control the outcome of election and put citizens in charge of their voting decisions. We urge the committee to move this bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. I'm Dave Barenberg, Legislative Director from the League of Oregon Cities, and with me is Corvallis Mayor Helen Berg, who is this year's President of the League of Oregon Cities. And I thought the Mayor would present some general testimony, and I'll just provide a little bit more statistical information and walk very briefly through some of the findings of our study. Mayor.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Helen Berg. I'm mayor of the city of Corvallis and this year's president of the League of Oregon Cities. I first of all would like to extend my thanks to Senator Devlin and Representative Hunt, who I was just looking around to see if they were still here, but on behalf of the 240 cities of the state of Oregon, we are grateful that this Senate joint resolution is coming forward. Two-thirds of the people of Oregon live in cities, and cities provide services that no other level of government provides, and therefore we are always very concerned about our ability to fund them. I am a politician, as you are, and I don't think politician is a four-letter word. Oregon voters have approved the double majority when they passed the property tax cut and cap measure 47 in 1996, and they approved that with a 52% yes vote, and in 1997 its legislative rewrite measure 50. Has been pointed out, however, the double majority was not the headline at that time of this bill. Measure 4750 imposed a new voter turnout requirement for property tax elections, commonly referred to as the double majority. Beyond the standard yes-no majority, simple majority vote, tax measures have to achieve at least a 50% voter turnout in order to pass. The only exception, as has been pointed out, is currently general elections in even-numbered years, and the double majority applies only to local government property tax measures and not to any state tax increase. In May 1998, a year after the passage of Measure 53, the legislature referred the double majority question to voters separately, and has that been pointed out, it was upheld by a vote of 51-49. So that was closer. There were 623,410 votes cast on the issue, and notably that was less than 50% of statewide eligible voters. So had this been a tax measure, it would have failed. Part of the reason for including the double majority requirement for property tax measures was the perception by some people of the so-called sneaky elections. Those were thought to have been placed on March and September ballots when many voters chose to go to the polls to cast ballots. But this was prior to mail-in voting. And there's no such thing as a sneaky election. They all show up in each voter's mailbox. I can assure you that sneaky is not something you get away with, actually, at the local level. And we do a good deal of conferring county school districts and cities about coming forward to the voters in a way that meets their objectives. Also, you know, when these tax measures come to you in the mail, they're in an envelope that has a tax measure in red letters on the outside. It would be very difficult to miss. Now, one of the anecdotal stories about the double majority has been the concept that non-voters have as much or more impact on elections as those that cast ballots. But up until last year, there was no comprehensive documentation of this theory. And so the League of Oregon Cities staff stepped forward principally researcher Stephanie Nixon, and she began collecting results from all the elections, all the local elections in Oregon from 1997 through 2003. And, of course, those are the years since the enactment of the double majority, with the assistance of county election officials from all 36 counties. She assembled the election results and produced this report that we have submitted today. One of the fundamental principles of representative democracy is that citizens participate in the political process, and our report documents that the double majority runs counter to that philosophy and instead gives non-participants equal or even greater weight than participating voters. This fact contradicts one of the most basic principles of democracy in the United States, one person, one vote. Today, non-votes have become a determining factor in the outcome of many local elections. Typically, non-voters do not have an impact on the outcome of elections, but Oregon's double majority has changed that. The double majority requirement has skewed the Oregon voting system so that non-voters can influence the outcome of an election and can override a measure approved by a majority of the citizens who took the time to vote. And I just want to add one little thing to this, as long as we're talking about politicians and politics. When you're campaigning, you want to campaign for something positive and urge voters to get out and vote for something. Under this system, the most effective way to oppose something is to urge people to stay home. And that certainly is a skewing of the process. And I'll let Dave add.
This study that you have before you documented all property tax-related elections from 97 through 2003, of which there were 936 of all jurisdiction types. Since 97, that 122 out of the 936 failed due to the double majority. In many of the cases, those that voted overwhelmingly said yes, but voter turnout slightly lower than the required 50% resulted in the failure. In fact, half of the measures that failed under the double majority, which is 61, they would have passed if all the needed votes had to get to a 50% turnout had voted no.
So half of those. So a couple things. First, just your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Barenberg, League of Oregon Cities.
And then secondly, and it's partly because my early Alzheimer's, it's half of, can you repeat that statistic?
Yes, that half of the measures that failed under the double majority, which was 61 out of the 122 that failed, which is about a quarter of the votes that failed due to the double majority. And of those that failed due to the double majority, 61, which is half.
30?
Yeah. There are 122 that failed. And that of those, 61 would have passed if all those...
61 got the... won the popular vote, but lost because of the non-voters.
Even one more step beyond that.
Okay.
There are 122 that failed due to the double majority. And so that is what you said. But of those, half, 61, would have passed if all of the votes needed to get to the 50% number had voted no.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's just... in that no vote category.
They just need people to go vote now.
Yeah, exactly. And a couple examples of that, Cortland Community College lost the bond measure despite the fact that the yes votes exceeded no votes by 33,000. They only needed 2,000 votes to get to the double majority. So then in this election, each of the 2,200 no votes were essentially equivalent to 15 no votes. You know, just that margin of getting there. That each of those votes essentially had the effect of 15 votes because of just that margin, because they already had such a large margin to win. In a smaller government, it only takes a few votes to fail for a double majority. The Beaver Connor Water District, 126 registered voters. Water levy achieved 46% voter turnout. The 4% required to meet the double majority amounted to 5 votes. For Portland during the same election, that would have been an equivalent of 10,000 votes in the same number. Another good example was in Deschutes County, a police levy was on the 2001 ballot. It received 22,000 yes votes, 7,000 no votes. So the measure achieved 44% voter turnout and failed. The county only needed 3,800 votes to achieve a 50% turnout. If all 3,800 votes had been cast as a no, the measure would have still passed more than 2-1. And there are just more and more examples of that in small cities and large cities where in Sweet Home, twice they went out, about 48%, with very turnout, with large majorities voting yes. Finally, on the third try, got 55% turnout, 71% yes. So there's time and expense in the cost of doing the elections. And then, you know, additionally, the double majority assumes the existence of accurate and up-to-date voter registration. While individual county clerks do their best to maintain the current records, without computerized statewide voter registration, voter information rolls can't possibly be kept the most accurate way. When I was growing up, I sort of learned that the only place that the dead voted was in Chicago. And in this case, it allows essentially people who are maintained on the voter rolls just because of the time and updating. Sometimes that now happens in Oregon as a no vote on these measures. So just to close, the requirement contradicts our fundamental concepts of fairness. All mail voting is eliminated, whatever purposes may have been behind this at the outset. And the minor change proposed in this resolution would at least level the playing field for voters and non-voters in 3 elections per 2-year cycle. And it's a change I think that the Oregonians should be eager to accept. And being sort of a boring guy, I found this really fascinating, just the statistics and on how we broke down all the elections. And it goes through per election and per types of levies, and it's just an interesting reading. Have the opportunity. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you. Sorry I missed Ms. Eaton, Mayor Berg. Sorry I missed your testimony. I just need to talk to the sponsor of the bill for one moment and accomplish that.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you bet. Ms. Satterspiel? Satterspiel. Satterspiel.
Maybe I should write it phonetically. Sorry.
I won't mispronounce it again till next week. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. I'm Lori Satterspiel, Oregon Community College Association, Government Relations. And first, can I start by wishing the Vice Chair a very happy anniversary?
Yeah.
That is awesome. I'm here to testify today in support of SDR 14. You've heard it all. And we support all of those comments. And David actually testified to some of our impact on the 49.6% turnout for PCC's election. The impact on that particular college having to rerun the bond election, which was eventually passed, was more use of scarce resources by the college. What they calculated in the loss of with the loss of time and running the bond to get to their construction process, $1.75 million to the construction costs, and that's another huge impact. Rogue Community College is my other one that I'd like to enter into the record. Again, they've passed their bond levy eventually as well, with the same sort of impacts to having to run the election process again. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. You've heard it all. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Questions or comments for Ms. Satterspiel? Thank you very much. Anyone else on SJR 14? Going once. Going twice. close public hearing, open a work session on SJR 14. Committee, I feel this is a modest compromise between outright repeal. It adds the May opportunity, and I think this is worthy of public discussion. Maybe I'm the only one.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree. First of all, I'll make a motion. I move Senate Joint Resolution 14 to the floor to do pass recommendations.
Thank you. Senator Metzger has moved SJR 14 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, comment, questions, Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote for this. I'd prefer two elections to three, but I feel that this is a tremendous improvement. Allows opportunities for local districts in the off year. If the House bill comes in a different form, we may have to compromise at some point. But it's worthy of the open debate, floor discussion. So I'm going to be voting in favor of moving this on to the Senate floor.
Thank you, Senator Starr. And I do note, too, the addition of two mays. And so that's something I think we will talk to the House about if they move forward. But that's something I'm willing to also, if we go to a conference on this, I'd put that on the record right now that perhaps this would be end up as just May and November, and maybe not that third May. I'm open either way on that one. Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point that Senator Starr brought up. I'm just trying to calculate how much time would have to pass between, and you know, if we find ourselves looking at compromising, it would seem to me that we, instead of having two in one year, that you may just want one in each of the years so you actually have that opportunity. But I'm going to support it as well. And I guess it, we're putting the parameters aside boards as to the limitations of when these type of measures can actually move forward, and it seems to be reasonable, and it is times that are, let's say, more customary for people to be in tune. And I think the both Senator Devlin and Representative Hunt made it pretty clear that, you know, we have had a change in how our elections are carried out. And since we're not actually trying to get people physically to a polling place as compared to coming to their doorstep through the mailbox, that it's reasonable to allow that that opportunity to be modified. And I think that the voters will, in fact, look at this based on the change in how our process is for elections, that we're not seeing a taxing authority trying to, quote-unquote, sneak something in a special election where people may not even be attuned to something actually occurring.
Yeah, that's the only thing I worry about a little on the May and the odd year,
mm-hmm.
is just when this does go to the ballot, or if and when it does go to the ballot, is that they might interpret that as, because I think people will easily see the May and November in the even year, both presidential and then for us gubernatorial, being the big race, as easily high turnout, and it is, I would agree in some ways, it might be that May and the odd year. Maybe we just put this on the May and the odd year ballot. Joking. But so I would be happy to move this forward, or we could wait and amend that May out.
Senator Dickens?
Yeah.
And I will certainly support this, and I think, as others have said, there may be, you know, further discussion through the process on this, and certainly open to that. I see this as, however, as written, it's certainly fair. I mean, if you thought, let's say, if we were to have something that eliminated the odd year, which is this year, for example, mm-hmm. the May election, following the November election, you would actually be looking a year and a half before you could have another election. I mean, that's, so this gives some, you know, gives in the odd year one time in a year, and then the two, and then as Senator Brzezinski pointed out, these are usual and customary election dates, primary and general, mm-hmm. And all the other points that people have made, how our election process has changed. You know, we're not making people, and when they're on vacation, you know, go to a poll for something that somebody put something on a September ballot. It's a lot different. And I think even then, looking at the late 90s, when the total repeal of the double majority, and if you remember, the at that time, certainly the political winds were, I think, stronger on these issues then than they are now. And it was almost a repeal, the whole thing was, at that time. So I think it is a legitimate question to ask voters to have the opportunity for these measures on your usual and customary dates, and we strongly support it.
Good point. And I think Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, I wanted to try to get the schematic out, just I think for the record. I mean, if we were using this May as the odd year on 05, between it and the next possible election would be 12 months. And then from the May of 06 to the general election in November of 06, you got 6 months. And then you have a 7-month period between the general before the May, the odd year. So, I mean, there's going to be an opportunity for, I think, the districts to be able to reach the voters. But at the same time, it's not going to be, so repetitive that there is going to be a break in time. And hopefully this will allow for those taxing districts that are looking for some type of submission to their voters will take and reflect on the timing, and also giving some flexibility that it's not just locked into only even years. Mm-hmm. But then we'll see what the House says.
Yeah, and I'm sure they will say something. Okay, so that is actually a really good discussion on where we should move. So Senator Metzger has moved Senate Joint Resolution 14 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Barbara, do you want to call the roll on this vote?
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Senator Brzezinski.
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr.
Aye.
Chair Deckard.
Votes aye. Motion passes. Senator Devlin will carry that bill. And good. Close the work session on SJR 14. Thank you, Steve. Okay. Open a public hearing on SB 13, and while Paul gets situated, I feel important to correct my earlier statement that I've been married 2 or 3 years and say it's been 5 years and coming on 6 in June.
2 or 3, that's
for
the record.
That is very much for the record.
Hopefully the treasurer's office is listening.
I know. Paul Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 315 is a bill sponsored by Senator Gordley, and I think Senator Gordley will be on her way down in a few minutes. So, okay, all right, okay. What the bill does is it authorizes the Department of Revenue to enter the streamlined sales and use tax agreement. It declares entering the agreement will reduce the burden of compliance for Oregon businesses and outlines requirements agreement must have for Oregon to participate. I've copied, and I hope all of you have this on your nightstands, your NCSL, New Realities in State Finance, which I think is a good summary of the issues that states are facing in their revenue systems. But I did copy for you just 2 pages on the streamlined sales tax project. This, of course, is an extremely serious issue for the retail sales tax, for the 45 retail sales tax states. The catalyst has been the growth of internet sales and the concerns both in terms of state tax collections, because the Supreme Court has ruled that states cannot tax remote sellers unless they have a physical presence in their states. And also there's some real economic issues in terms of competitiveness that local merchants are put at a disadvantage relative to remote sellers, because in a sales tax state you're taxing the local merchant but not the competitor who's selling mail order or through the internet. What the streamlined sales tax project is designed to do is to simplify the design, administration, and compliance requirements of the state sales tax and reduce the burden of sales and use tax collection. That's one of the key arguments in the Quill case was that it's an undue burden on companies to try to deal with this a wide variety of definitions that states use for sales tax in terms of exemptions, in terms of rates. And so the idea of the project is to try to require some uniform definitions within state tax laws. For example, there's no you're not required to exempt certain things, you're just required to have the same definition across states. So if you exempt a food for home consumption, for example, there's a consistent definition. The base and rate simplification requires a limitation to just one rate. You can have a local sales tax option like Washington has, but the goal is to have those rates identical across the state. So you would have, for example, maybe a 1 cent rate for all the counties in the state, so there wouldn't be variations. There's also a series of rules on administration, audits, and state funding of the system in terms of technology. And then there's a uniform sourcing rules that states have a uniform and simple rules of sourcing. And the key issue there is whether the tax is based on destination or origin. And that's where there's been some issues that have come up in discussion among the states. Currently, the agreement is that you have to have states that comprise 10 states that comprise 20% of the U.S. population by July 1 of 2005 in compliance with the terms would put the agreement into effect. The latest we have, and this is a March 28, so this is just released in our state tax notes, shows that 15 states have approved conforming legislation, and they comprise 24.1% of the U.S. population. So they've met those criteria. But the other step is that on July 1, they have to be in compliance with the terms of the agreement. And so the one issue that this article, in fact, that just came out is questioning is the sourcing issue, that there's a controversy. Small businesses don't want it to have an origin sourcing. They want to have a destination-based. And then there's larger companies are looking at it differently. So that's an issue that needs to be worked out. But all in all, there's an enormous incentive for states with consumption taxes to enter into some type of agreement in order to create greater uniformity, reduce administrative costs, and ultimately to keep the tax base from eroding significantly.
So the two questions when I read the bill, and we're going to have shown up in just a second, are first is why a state wouldn't do that. I mean, I don't understand why a state that had a consumption tax wouldn't enter in, because it's just obviously negotiated by them in their interest. And then second, in reading it, Paul, the question is by directing our Department of Revenue to enter into this agreement without Oregon being one of those states with a sales tax, would that be problematic to enter in when we are not actually one of the affected states?
Okay. I did talk briefly with Deborah, and she would not anticipate an impact under current law in terms of the fiscal impact. I think, and Sean can address this, but I think that the it certainly is, and when we've looked at sales tax proposals, we have recommended that this approach be adopted, because it would create a lot more uniformity in terms of how the bill is developed, how the tax base is determined. So I would tend to agree that there's a very powerful incentive, if you are going to have a sales tax, to go ahead and be a part of this agreement. Now, why all the states haven't joined, there's a variety of reasons. I think there are different stages of looking at conforming legislation. I think there's some issues. As I mentioned, this origin destination issue is one there isn't complete agreement on. There's some states, some arguments that, you know, if this is what you really need in a situation like this to ensure uniformity is some type of federal legislation. And the Supreme Court decisions have certainly not precluded that. And in fact, there is an NCSL has made an effort in recent years to try to get federal legislation. So I think there may be some states that may be waiting to see if the federal government wouldn't impose a system that they would be insured would have participation. So I think some states may be concerned that if they participate, not everyone else will. And so then you've got your vendors that are responsible for collecting a sales tax on remote sales, and maybe in other states aren't. Mm. So you've got that competitiveness angle, unless you're insured that all will agree. Mm. But I think from a system as a whole, as I say, there's a very powerful incentive and motive for states to work out something, because their tax base is eroding. The costs that have been done are enormous. The cost estimates are growing. So instead of the situation we see in Oregon, where our income tax is growing at the same rate of income or even slightly faster, you look at the sales tax projections and they're growing slower than income over time. And this is one of the key reasons.
Hmm. And is it problematic for us to, I mean, Mr. Cruz, we'll talk. Maybe why don't we just bring up Mr. Sean Cruz and Senator Brzezinski while he gets settled in.
Yeah, and once Sean comes up, I guess a question for both Mr. Cruz and for Paul. I guess I'm kind of stumped as to why we would be participating at this stage, since we have no sales tax, knowing that whenever that has gone out for votes, what the outcome has been. I appreciate and understand from other uniform acts that it's important that if you're a part of it, want to be a participant and drawing up those uniformity rules that are going to be applied nationwide, why it's important. But it seems like, number one, it seems like we're going to maybe dedicate money to have someone participating in this at a time where maybe our resources wouldn't justify being there, because we don't have sales tax at this point. And two, it also seems to me, because of what we're talking about, it appears to be the internet sales or the internet marketing, that you're probably going to see something coming out on a federal level to deal with this as compared to a state by state. But clearly, I understand and appreciate why if we had a sales tax, I'd say, yeah, we definitely need to do that, but we don't. So I'm hoping to maybe get some discussion testimony from Mr. Cruz or from Paul Warner as to how this will play out. And I guess we may have some discussion as to what the cost might be. May not be
anything
to really be concerned with, but I'm just not sure what our involvement actually means.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Mr. Cruz. This was a big issue. I mean, I remember when it came out of NCSL. This is a huge issue nationally and in those states, because Mr. Pound, the director, was in Oregon talking to us about it. And
I remember when the publication came out. I mean, we got two of them, one from NCSL, and then there's another one that wasn't streamlining, but just talking about sales taxes around the country, mm-hmm. and giving, you know, different ratings of how people rely on whatever it might be in their state.
Yeah. Mr. Cruz.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cruz, Senator Gordley's legislative aide, and I'm appearing today representing the office of Senator Gordley. Thank you for hearing this bill. To get directly to Chair Deckert and Senator Brzezinski, to your question, the last time I looked, two of the five states that do not have sales taxes were in the process of implementing, of joining the agreement. This is a process that's taking place over time, you know, with biannual sessions and maybe part of they only get it partway through the system and then they have to start over again. Those sort of dynamics are playing out there. But what really lies behind all this is the Supreme Court decision to bar the collection of taxes on remote sales. And as Mr. Warner indicated, sales tax collections in the changing economy and the growing importance of internet sales that's flattening out. And as we move to a more service-based economy nationwide, the sales taxes revenues are flattening out. What the states that have sales tax in place, a vital part of what keeps their systems running, they're seeing that they're losing in cigarette taxes alone tens of billion dollars a year. It's enormous, and that's just that part of it. So what they are working on is addressing the Supreme Court's bar, which is there's currently roughly 8,000 sales taxing jurisdictions nationwide. The burden on the sellers to keep track of all of those jurisdictions when so many things change on a local level. For instance, there's an annexation takes place, and suddenly the sales tax formula changes for a neighborhood or a particular area. Under current law, the remote seller would have to be responsible for collecting the correct amount of tax. And that burden is just too overwhelming, particularly for small businesses. That led to the Supreme Court's ban, which then started the ball rolling for the states that do rely on sales taxes and see this as the taxes that they're not collecting is legitimate. That revenue belongs to the state, so they are doing everything they can to capture those, and that's what leads to the streamlined sales and use tax agreement, which would restrict each state to only one tax rate statewide, and also shift the burden away from the seller as to who is responsible for collecting that tax. Those are the chief barriers. So what we see then is that eventually that Supreme Court ban is expected to change. This is a nonpartisan issue. There's blue states, there's red states. The most conservative, the most liberal, they're all in line one way or another. There's more than 40 states that are in the process of implementation. I believe it's 15 that are fully implemented now, and they've also passed the 10% of the national population requirement. This was an issue that Senator Gourley became aware of in 2003. And she sponsored a bill then that would have called for Oregon to join the agreement. That bill didn't get a hearing, but our office has been monitoring this for that length of time, and we feel that it's a necessary for Oregon to have some kind of official presence as these discussions go forward, because we are participating and competing in a worldwide economy. And interstate commerce is a vital piece of that. There's no way that this won't impact Oregon at some place down the line, and we just feel that we should recognize that we're not a state that's all here by ourselves, but we need to have somebody, an expert that is keeping Oregon in the loop on what's going on.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Questions for Mr. Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I would add one thing on the discussion that seems to have died out a little bit. What was very heated a couple of years ago was the issue on federal legislation and what kind of trade-offs would there be. And the concern was that there may be trade-offs to have streamlined type agreement nationally that would hurt Oregon. In other words, Oregon wouldn't get the benefits, but then would be negatively affected. Specifically, it was around business nexus on how corporate income taxes are applied at the state level. So there was a lot of concern about that, and that kind of gets to Sean's point about staying within the loop, because at that time, Representative Williams was the NCSL representative talking about that. So there are some real potential implications for the state indirectly.
I do remember that. That's why Pound was, Mr. Pound was out there, right, to talk about that very issue with us.
Yes.
That's right. Can you stay here for just 1 second, Mr. Cruz?
Sure.
Deborah Buchanan, can you answer Senator Prezanski's question of would there be a cost to the department?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, as Mr. Cruz indicated, this seems to be just one piece of a larger process. We don't actually see significant cost to the department unless a sales tax were adopted by the state. So entering the agreement, I'm not sure has a practical effect for us absent a sales tax in Oregon.
What form does it take? Do we just let them know if this actually went to the governor's desk that we are now a part of? I mean, I am aware whenever you talk to states, Washington, we just have to go north or south. It's a very big issue for them. And what, we would just join that agreement as a co-signator? All that, bro.
Yeah, maybe in other areas, such as extradition, there's basically a way that you basically make it known, and then if you're within that first group of signatories, then you're there to make rules. And it's basically whoever's coordinating the project, notice is given to them once we have officially taken that position and do it. Mm-hmm. And then the question at that point is, they normally are going to have some type of responsibility to have attendance at meetings. So much probably done over internet and stuff like that, as to email. But there's a participation where you actually have an active part and a responsibility to be part of that original group, and then they're going to make the rules. And that's the one thing I guess, as much optimist we may have, or some people thinking that we're going to see a change in our revenue structure, doesn't seem, I mean, too likely to me that we're going to be going there anytime soon in the way of sales taxes. But and Deborah, I understand you don't see it as significant. Have you or anyone in the department ever been in one of these national type of groups or dealing with issues, and give us your experience as to what type of involvement that might require?
Mr. Chair, Senator Prezanski, actually we are a participating member of the Multi-State Tax Commission. The director just completed her term as chair of the commission, and so we do have experience in involvement in national groups in that area. But Mr. Chair, if I could just add and perhaps address some of the comments as well. The businesses that are in this state will be able to take advantage of other states' participation in the streamlined sales tax program, even though Oregon does not have a tax, and whether or not we enter the agreement, they will be able to take advantage of that, because there are businesses that are now collecting sales taxes on sales that are made into other states. So they can sign up through the centralized registration process and take advantage of other states' simplification methods. So they are not burdened by the fact that Oregon is not yet part of the agreement in that sense.
So they are advantaged in that respect. Okay. Well,
Mr. Chair, could you just follow up on that as to how they're taking advantage of it? Are you saying that we have Oregon companies that are taxing people out of state based on their rate of tax in that state if they're doing internet sales to someone outside of the state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Prezanski, as Mr. Warner described, a business can be required to collect sales tax on remote sales if it has a physical presence in the state where the consumer is. So, for example, if I had an Oregon business and I had a branch of that business in California, and someone walks into the California store and buys a product, they would be charged sales tax, obviously. Mm-hmm. But if that California resident calls the Oregon store and orders the product and it's shipped to them, that company has a presence in California, and the Oregon company is required to collect sales tax on the sale to the California resident and remit that to California.
Okay. Deborah, can you meet with Mr. Cruz and maybe look at, and Paul, if you want to get involved at all, is, okay, I guess the two questions I would have are, one, is there, being a part of the agreement, is there a lot of, if there are meetings and this, if there are fiscal impacts that would not be in our interest, but we would be going to, then I would be concerned. So look into what actually joining the agreement entails, but also then the upside of, are there parts of it that actually would benefit companies here and folks here, and that the obligations other than joining at this point are minimal. If y'all could have that conversation, that would help us.
Sure. Chair Decker, members, I can provide some clarification for that in that much of the agreement consists of agreement on definitions. And that has a lot of importance, and they use as an example a Twix bar. And whether it's classified as a food or candy, contains flour. So by some states' definition, if it contains flour, it's a food. Other states have defined it as a candy. Some states collect a sales tax on candy, but not on food. And so just something like that can create enormous implications across the states if you're the person that's manufacturing and distributing Twix bars. The other part is that the terms of the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement, and this is one of the key provisions of it, is that they're voluntary on the parts of the states. The states can choose, as they determine individually, which elements of the provision they agree with and want to sign on to. So that's one of the key underpinnings of how this the agreement was reached in the first place, the voluntary aspect of it.
Good. That is helpful. Other thoughts or comments? Thank you. Appreciate Mr. Cruz. I know you have... you have spent some time looking into this, and I think we as a state have benefited that your office has taken this up. And if that day ever comes, your work will definitely guide Oregon, I think, if we do reform our tax structure. Thank you. With that, we will close SB 315 and adjourn for March 31st, the 49th anniversary of Senator and Mrs. Charles Starr.
Can I say something?
Sure.
I just wanted to note, and Kim has put it in yellow, or Barbara has on your schedule, but that we are planning to meet next Friday.
That's so true.
To get that on your calendars, because that's the deadline for considering Senate bills. So we'll plan to have a meeting on Friday, and the agenda will depend on how far you get on some of these bills earlier in the week.
Yeah. If we get through everything, then we're not going to get through everything, mm-hmm. but we need to get through 95% of everything for this committee. So
if you get through everything, you can party.
That's right. We can have a Friday celebration of Senator Starr's 49th anniversary. Adjourn the Senate Revenue Committee. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, right.